From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee.
Ours was not a campaign, but rather an incredible and great movement made up of millions of hardworking men and women who love their country and want a better, brighter future for themselves and for their family.
That's, of course, the voice of America's new president-elect, Donald Trump. Today, we focus on what happens now. We'll hear from people at both ends of the political spectrum about their concerns and hopes now that the campaign is finally over. It's something our listeners have considered, all of you out there. Here are some of your first thoughts. Kristen Richards tweets, "Will we ever be able to go back to conducting more normal and civilized elections now that we've suffered through this one?" It's a good question, Christian. And Cindy Lou Harrington called us from Stone Mountain, Georgia. She voted early, but did not want to say who she voted for.
I had a real struggle when I got in the voting booth, and so I just wanted to acknowledge how hard it is. I wish we did have the option of a third party.
We always love to hear your thoughts, so call us and leave a message like Cindy did at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post on Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. If there's anything to say about the results of the election of the presidential race, it's that it defied expectations and most predictions. Many expected to wake up Wednesday morning to hear from President-elect Hillary Clinton. Instead, it was Donald Trump who came out on top. Speaking to supporters last night, he congratulated Clinton on a hard-fought campaign, and he had this message.
For America to bind the wounds of division, we have to get together. To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people.
One of Trump's major victories for the night was Georgia's 16 electoral votes. From there, his path to 270 continued, and he did defeat Clinton in the end, although it looks as though Clinton right now won the popular vote for the moment. For more on last night's election and a look down the ballot, I'm joined by Charles Richardson. He's the editorial page editor for The Telegraph in Macon. Hi, Charles.
Good morning.
And with us from Washington, D.C. is Emory University professor Andra Gillespie. Hi, Andra.
Good morning.
Andra, look, there's a lot of people talking about what the election means, and many of them are characterizing what a vote for Trump meant. But do we know, for the millions of people who supported Trump, do we know what it was they were actually supporting?
Well, if we look at the exit polls, the preliminary data suggests that they wanted a mandate for change. Trump does extremely well amongst those who thought that traits were an important characteristic or change was an important trait that they wanted in their next president. We also see different perceptions of the world. So, for instance, if you think that we're losing the fight against ISIS, you're more inclined to support Trump, though not to the same degree that those who think that the fight is going well would support Clinton. But it's more of them who think that ISIS, the fight against ISIS is going poorly. If you thought that Supreme Court appointments were the most important issue, then you were much more likely to support Trump than you were to support Clinton. And then those who didn't think it was that important just tended to be less numerous. In effect, the story of this election is Clinton's underperformance. She didn't lose the constituencies that we thought she would win. It's just that she didn't perform as well amongst those groups, and Trump just had a tighter coalition.
So, Charles, to a certain extent, isn't it fair to say that no matter who won last night, half of the country, or about half, would be angry this morning?
I think that's exactly right. I think they, you know, sometimes image is everything. And I think that Trump was short on details, and you can get by with image. And I think he got by with image. He hit some straight points. He just kept hitting those points over and over again. His message was clear. And he sold a lot of people that message, and it was successful for him.
Joining us from the North Georgia town of Blue Ridge is Mark Thomason. He's the publisher of The Fan and Focus. Thanks for weighing in here, Mark.
Good morning.
So here's the question, and there are many, many questions this morning. But for me, the number one question, and I'll give you all a chance to address this, is how do we get past this? And I say that not because Donald J. Trump won the election. I think it would be true, even if Clinton did, that I think it's going to be, while it may have been successful as a campaign strategy, the divisive election we just went through might make it extremely hard to govern. Are you seeing signs of that, Mark, where you are?
Absolutely. You know, last night I was in a large crowd. There was banner back and forth all night long. It's almost like, you know, the voting population of the country has joined in this fight. It was almost like a boxing match instead of an election. And everyone's going to have to realize, you know, calm those emotions back down. There are real issues at hand, and let's start addressing those issues.
So let me then send that to you, Andra, because a campaign is very different from governance. And many of the promises that Donald Trump made on the campaign trail, like many politicians, frankly, are things that constitutionally he will not be able to follow through with, I mean, barring a constitutional amendment. So how does the governance look, do you think?
I think that's going to be really interesting, and I think that's going to show how solid or how fragile a Trump coalition is. One of the things that is interesting, I think this gives us a chance to test our institutions. We're really going to see what separations of powers look like. We really are going to see what checks and balances look like, even with him, with the Republicans controlling Congress. And I think we're going to see whether or not presidential authority expands during this period, as it has historically over the course of the life of our nation, or whether Congress is going to seek to be a check on the power of the presidency. And some of the things that Donald Trump promised as president that appeared to be unconstitutional.
My guests are Charles Richardson of The Telegraph in Macon. You just heard Emory University Professor Andra Gillespie and the publisher of The Fan and Focus, Mark Thomason. So, Charles, how much do, say, Trump supporters believe he can deliver? Or do we feel that the American public at large is realistic about what can be accomplished through politics?
Well, I think you make promises, and I think Trump has made a number of them. But you have different segments of the economy that, quite frankly, are roiled this morning. You had the markets drop 800 points last night on the word that he might win. You've got the healthcare sector that is really kind of wondering, okay, what's coming now? You've got the House and Senate and the presidency controlled by Republicans, and they've promised to repeal Obamacare. But what, with what? So they're trying to figure out what's going to happen. What are you going to do? And they're set up to say, okay, now what's coming down the road? And no sector of the economy likes the uncertainty that they are faced with over the next 6-8 months.
So, Mark, we did see record numbers of voters in Georgia, at least, despite people talking about a disenchanted and, in some cases, disenfranchised electorate. What do you think drove the high numbers here in our state?
Again, I think it was that excitement that seemed to be contagious. Whether it was, you know, here locally in North Georgia, we absolutely set record number turnouts. Our early voting numbers were through the roof. And in Fannin County, the voting turnout as a whole was shattering. But I think it was that whole excitement, just like the World Series that just got played. It's that seventh inning, our seventh game, ninth inning, you know, two outs, you're at bat. And I think the voter felt like their vote would actually make a difference this time.
So then let me bring this back, Andra, to what we were talking about a moment ago, because objectively speaking, a number of the catchphrases that Donald Trump used quite a bit in terms of banning Muslims, building a wall that Mexico would pay for, deporting 11 million immigrants. He even expressed support for possibly bringing back the Defense of Marriage Act, which it seems to me that would be those. So many of those things are constitutionally very difficult, if not because of SCOTUS decision, impossible at this point. So I remember the disenchantment with Obama voters when he first got into office and he had said, you know, I'm right out of the gate, I'm going to close Guantanamo. Remember that? And then there was all this disappointment when it turns out that that's not how politics works. Because there was so much divisiveness and passion on both sides, what do we think happens when that disenchantment occurs, as it probably will during a Trump administration?
Well, I think it's really interesting. Because change appears to be the mandate of Donald Trump, he represents a 180-degree turn from politics as usual. And the people who are supporting that I think, are operating under the principle of it's insane to keep on putting the same people in positions of power and expecting different results. So now we have a nice experiment. We have somebody who is completely different, who's going to bring some familiar faces back, but who's likely going to bring in a very, very fresh face team. They have an opportunity to try to implement policy, to try to work with Congress, to see what's going on. So I think the question will be, can this group do something that's different? And that will help to separate what is institutionally possible versus what is institutionally not particularly possible. Because there are certain things that you learn once you get in office that we've structured it for incremental change. We've structured it to make sure that we don't see these radical changes. And that can be comforting on one end when certain things can't change. But then it also, the question then becomes, well, will people be frustrated by the lack of change? And, you know, I'm not quite sure what will happen. We would have to wait to see. Potentially, the next move might be, say, the Trump administration can't get certain things done, would then be to run against Congress and then see whether or not you see a big turnover in the congressional representation, not just amongst Democrats, but also amongst Republicans, too, if not all Republicans get online. I think that's the real interesting thing right now. Even within the Republican camp, those who oppose Trump are probably feeling a little sheepish right now. And so what their fate looks like and how and what stances they take, I think, also look very, very different with the light of day now that the election is over.
So, Mark Thomason, there in North Georgia, did you also get the sense that for the most part, the people who support Trump there were voting for just a clean slate change, wiping it clean, as Trump would say, draining the swamp?
Draining the swamp, absolutely. You know, I've interviewed a lot of Trump supporters at the newspaper, and they list issue after issue that they claim to have a continual problem with, whether they really have or not. You know, we haven't heard them voice those concerns over the past, but they are looking for a complete change.
And Charles, right before we go here for a moment, complete change is going to be difficult to come by. Do we have the patience? Right. Does our electorate have the patience to stick with it anyway?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things that you heap on the president. One thing I think President Trump is going to figure out is that the president doesn't have a whole lot of power. You know, we said we've changed the presidency, but here in middle Georgia, Austin Scott returns to his House seat. Sanford Bishop returns to his House seat. Johnny Isaacson returns to his Senate seat. Senate still doesn't have a 60-vote Republican majority.
Which is required to break filibusters, yeah.
Exactly. So how much can change? And again, there is this bureaucracy in Washington that, as said before, is dealing with incremental change. And each institution sort of has this this shield around it to protect itself from quick change. So we'll see what happens. It's going to be a very interesting time, particularly the first 2 years.
We're taking a look back at results from last night's election, and I've got Charles Richardson with me. He's the editorial page editor for The Telegraph in Macon. Andra Gillespie, Emory University professor, joins us from Washington, D.C., and from North Georgia. The town of Blue Ridge is Mark Thomason. He's the publisher of The Fanon Focus. So, Charles, we had a surprising flip here in Metro Atlanta, at least. Last night, Cobb County, which has long been a Republican stronghold, flipped over to Clinton while we saw Trump take increasing margins in North and South Georgia. Any idea why we saw those changes?
Well, I think if you drive around Cobb County, you can see them for yourself and many other places in Atlanta. Demographics are changing in Georgia. We didn't have much of that in middle Georgia, but I think you can see it throughout. It's taking time, but there is a browning of Georgia. More Latinos, Hispanics are moving into the area. Asians are moving into the area, and that's just a natural order of things. You're going to see shifts all over the place, even to middle Georgia.
But, Andra, I think at this point, both of the major parties, both the Democrats and Republicans, will probably be doing soul searching, don't you think? And I think, as Charles is talking about the browning of Georgia, is it possible that Democrats have assumed that as demographics have changed, that would automatically mean more votes for their party and that they didn't do the outreach they needed to?
I think there's going to be a lot of soul searching, maybe not the same type of soul searching that we thought all the way around. I think most people anticipated that Donald Trump would lose and that the Republican Party was going to have a reckoning about the use of racial rhetoric and racial imagery. I'm not quite sure that conversation is going to be had at this point. And at the same time, the changes that we see in Metro Atlanta, not just Cobb County, but Gwinnett County as well, also turning blue for the first time, does have something to say about race. It also has something to say about class. When we drill down, we're going to have to ask that question about suburban white women. Nationally speaking, though, what was really interesting about this race was that, especially given the racialized rhetoric, we anticipated that Hillary Clinton was going to do better among minority groups than she, in fact, did. Nationally, if we look at the exit polls, Clinton underperformed relative to Obama and actually relative
to— Especially with black men.
Yes, which is actually not that unusual because that gender gap was present in 2012 as well.
Yeah.
It just got more acute. What seems to happen, it's not that Trump did better amongst these groups per se. He did do better amongst Asian Americans, or what looks to appear to be mostly Asian Americans. He did do better amongst African Americans than I think people would have anticipated that he would have done. But it was actually in the ballpark of what Republican candidates get generally. And actually at 8%, it actually puts him kind of on the lower end of the spectrum. What was more interesting about last night was the number of people who voted third party. And so Clinton underperforms because those voters who might have otherwise voted for her were choosing to vote for Gary Johnson or Jill Stein. And that contributes to this notion of underperforming. Had all of those people who voted third party or other or didn't cast a vote for president voted for her, this would have been a very, very different outcome.
We've got just about a minute left, Mark. Do you get the sense there in North Georgia that went heavily for Trump that we can now, as an American populace, unite and have civil conversations?
You know, the united part, the coming together, the working together, the people that I've discussed with the election outcome so far, that has not even been a topic or a concern. It's more they're still in celebratory mode.
Yeah.
We'll see. Hopefully they can. Yeah. We'll see.
Yet to be seen. Yeah. That is Mark Thomason, publisher of The Fan in Focus. And also we had Charles Richardson of The Telegraph in Macon and Andra Gillespie of Emory University. Thanks so much to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We enter a new political era in America today, but much more than who occupies the Oval Office is poised to change. What's ahead for our nation socially and politically? We asked some Georgians to think about that, and now we'll hear their ideas about what the new national conversation might be in the wake of this election and Donald Trump's victory. The first voice you hear is from Republican Demetrius Minor in Augusta. He believes the 2016 election has done irreparable damage to the empowerment of voters.
What would American politics look like under our new president? Well, after a volatile and unpredictable election cycle, one that has pushed many Americans to support one candidate simply as a vote against the other one, I see an unhealthy republic. We have voters that are so turned off, they don't even want to be engaged in the political process, not just on a national level, but on a local level as well, where it truly matters. And you can't blame them for feeling this way. Many Americans on both sides of the political spectrum feel as if their elected representatives have betrayed them. This is what led to the rise of Bernie Sanders. Millennials, in particular, felt like he was the only politician who was genuine, sincere, authentic, and had their best interests at heart. We're at a point in our history where Americans simply distrust government, politicians, and they are clinging to anyone who can not only speak to their disdain and frustration, but can also buck the trend of political correctness. Many of Donald Trump's outlandish statements would have had a typical presidential candidate disqualified from the race, while Hillary Clinton's ethical challenges would have doomed the hopes of any other ordinary candidate. But with a different kind of electorate that simply wants someone to advocate on their behalf, the normal political behavioral patterns do not seem to matter. But there was one thing that is certain. experts and pundits will have to reevaluate the course of political science to try to catch up with a cultural paradigm shift that has redefined contemporary politics.
Demetrius Miner is the author of Preservation and Purpose, The Making of a Young Millennial and a Manifesto for Faith, Family, and Politics. Concerns about violence are on the mind of our next commentator. John Jefferson is an Athens-based novelist who says this election has left us with the threat of conflict right here at home.
You can't escape the flood of news stories about police officers shooting black people, or anti-Muslim rhetoric, or Donald Trump's riding a wave of alt-right bigotry toward the White House. Me, I can't help flashing back to the Alabama of my childhood 50 years ago. I grew up in a small town during the heyday of segregationist Governor George Wallace and the turmoil of the civil rights movement, the time of Bloody Sunday in Selma and bombs in Birmingham, as angry whites lashed out indiscriminately against African Americans seeking equality. In high school, I got religion and felt called to the ministry. At 16, I became a Methodist lay pastor. One day I passed a hand-lettered sign posted on the roadside near my church, "Klan meeting tonight." I was astonished. I'd imagined the KKK was over and done with. I was also baffled. Who would go to a Klan meeting in this sleepy crossroads? Being young and unsure of myself, I didn't ask about the sign, but I remember it well, especially now against the backdrop of Ferguson and Black Lives Matter and White Lives Matter and Charleston, and a sickening rise in hate groups and Klan groups and anti-Muslim violence. Donald Trump's Muslim bashing has been mirrored by, perhaps partly responsible for, vandalism and arson at mosques, widespread harassment, and brutality against innocent Muslims. This fall in Covington, Georgia, a Muslim group's plan to build a mosque was thrown into doubt when a militia group staged a protest at the proposed site. Some of the militia members wore fatigues and carried assault rifles. Their spokesman called the local Muslims a future ISIS training group. It's not far to Covington from where I live in Athens, Georgia, or from anywhere else in America. The back roads of bigotry and dark alleys of violence could quickly take us all to Covington. From there, it's only a hop, skip, and a rope back to Bloody Sunday and on to a bloody future.
Novelist John Jefferson lives in Athens. We've asked some Georgians to tell us what they think might be the next big national conversation in the wake of this election. Robbie Medwood thinks it might be hard to have any conversation at all. Robbie's a frequent guest on our Friday segment, The Break Room, and he's also an LGBTQ educator based in Atlanta.
The memes were everywhere in social media in the final days of this year's election. You know the ones I mean. They said things like, "There's more that unites us than divides us." Or, "All we need to do is sit down and talk with each other, and after the election, we need to put aside our differences and come together." My response is, how? How can I sit down at a table with someone who believes sexual assault is something that should be glossed over and excused? How can I work on building a relationship with someone who supports banning an entire religion from our country? How can I say that I love someone who has no problem putting a man in power who surrounds himself with evangelical leaders who would be happiest if LGBTQ people disappeared? This hasn't been a typical election by any means. We haven't been debating lofty policy ideas and working toward the betterment of the republic. We all believe that we've done what we've done in order to save the republic, but lines were crossed. Promoting a man who took his state's budget for HIV prevention and treatment and turned it over toward deadly and abusive conversion therapy crosses a line. Denying all evidence, including witnesses, of sexual assault and saying that those who have come forward are both doing it for attention and not even pretty enough to be assaulted crosses a line. We found ourselves back in a culture of church burnings and simulated lynchings and anti-Semitism and Islamophobia and all kinds of bigotry. Those kinds of problems can't simply be swept under the rug after the election. We're going to have to deal with our differences, and it's not going to be easy. Again, I ask, how? To find common ground starts with the assumption that there is humanity in the person across from you. Too many times, Trump and his supporters have ignored the humanity of others, and at this point, I honestly don't know how to have a relationship with someone who can do that.
Robbie Medwed is a writer and LGBTQ educator in Atlanta. Joining me now is John Jackson. He's a veteran and a farmer in Milledgeville, Georgia. He voted for Donald Trump and joins me by Skype. Hi, John.
How's it going?
It's going well, although I think we just heard three different views from different perspectives on the kind of concern that sort of gripped everybody today. And I wonder, are you concerned or hopeful, or what's your mood?
I'm extremely hopeful. I look at the landscape of voters that actually support Trump, and I understand that there is a huge chasm between, you know, the supporters who voted for Hillary and those who absolutely abhorred voting for Donald Trump, but also with the reality on the ground. The reality on the ground is that many of us, a vast majority of us, do not accept racism, do not accept bigotry. But we do understand that there are certain segments and pockets within this cause that do believe in those things. But we are here to call it out. You know, we don't accept those things, and we will call it out.
It is going to be a difficult conversation, though. I think there have been things said by both sides about the other side that are threatening in some cases, the insulting. It is difficult, as Robbie Medved said, to sort of walk back anything that's been said. How do you imagine this conversation, or how do you imagine your first conversation with someone who feels that they, whether they're Muslim, immigrant, Mexican, Black, whatever, that they were insulted by the man who would be our president, or actually more likely a supporter?
You know, one of the things that we have to start doing that we're not doing is really acknowledging that there is true fear out there. You know, a lot of people like to be dismissive. They like to think that, you know, people shouldn't be, you know, afraid of this or afraid of that. But I think empathy, really, everyone needs to establish a foundation of empathy and look on the other side and understand why that individual or that sect or that group has a certain fear, because the only way that we can address any problems is understanding where that fear is coming from. And I totally believe in that. So I totally believe in having conversations like this is a start, and also, you know, not using aggression, but using, you know, love and caring with just everyone.
So let's go over what you're hopeful about and what might concern you. Let's start with what you hope Donald Trump will have first on his to-do list when he is inaugurated.
Okay. Oh, wow. There's so many. You know, he has several plans that he wants to do with immigration, with the VA, with, you know, with trade and things like that. But I think the main thing, before we can even do any of that, what I'm hopeful that Donald Trump will do is just bring this country together, get everybody on the same playing field, and understand that he is working for every American.
Okay, so what is your concern? Especially, and I want to put this in context, this is yet another election like 2000 in which it appears Hillary Clinton won the popular vote but lost the electoral vote. So that is a divided nation by definition.
Absolutely. It is a divided nation. And what my concern is that the folks who have the blinders on, you know, with regards to Donald Trump and the folks who vote for him will act aggressively. I hope they do not. I hope that they accept this election as one that's a part of our democracy. It's, you know, we're one of the only places in the world that, you know, that's able to do, well, I shouldn't say one of the only places. I mean, there's several democracies all over the world, but we should be proud of what we've are able to establish, where we can pick a president to represent the people, even though there are a lot of people who don't want Donald Trump to represent him. But I hope that the resistance isn't violent.
Okay, so in the 30 seconds we have left, anything you would say to someone who voted for Hillary Clinton last night? And I mean, I assume that for other Trump supporters, you'd say, yay, this is a day of celebration. But what about for those who didn't vote for him?
I understand there's going to be some grief. I understand there's going to be some sorrow. But I want those folks to understand, too, that that this vote was for them. It's kind of like feeding them you know, green beans and rice instead of cake and cookies. You know, it's not going to be pleasant, but it's going to be good for the country. And I just want them to hold Donald Trump accountable for everything that he says and does, and that he will do. And that's what our country is about.
John Jackson is a farmer and veteran in Milledgeville. He cast his vote for Donald Trump. John, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, ma'am.
I hope you'll join us for a very special hour tomorrow. It's inspired by a new documentary series that will air on GPB later this month, Black America Since MLK and Still I Rise. That documentary examines how the fight for African-American civil rights has changed in modern times.
Clearly, some white Americans felt that black progress was coming at their own expense. And they focused their attention on the affirmative action programs put in place just a few years earlier.
There was never a honeymoon period for affirmative action. A lot of times people think, well, we had it for a couple of decades and then there was enough. There's never been a period where any effort to integrate African Americans into American society was not immediately denounced as preferential treatment.
I'm sorry that people had to go to the back of the bus, yet I was not here when it happened. I don't feel that I owe a black a thing for what happened in the past, and I'm not going to accept being eliminated from the job market or pushed back to pay somebody back.
I recently moderated a discussion on this topic here in Atlanta, the birthplace of Martin Luther King Jr., and tomorrow we'll listen to what three experts on civil rights, both past and present, had to say about issues like Black Lives Matter and racism in politics. But I'd really like to hear from you. Dr. King never swayed from his philosophy of nonviolence. And what do you think about that philosophy today? Can it still work? Call us at 404-500-9457, and then be sure to join me Thursday at 9 for more. The score for the Oscar-winning film Birdman sounded very different. That's because there was no orchestra, no synthesizers, just drums and cymbals, and a score improvised by Antonio Sanchez. Sanchez is originally from Mexico, but he came to America to study at the Berklee College of Music in the 1990s. He's performed with jazz luminaries like Pat Metheny and Chick Corea. He's now on tour with his original percussion score alongside a screening of Birdman. And Antonio Sanchez joins me now from NPR to discuss the project. Hi there.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. I mean, the first question that comes to me is that if the score for Birdman was improvised, how does it sound each time you play it during a screening?
Completely different from any other performance. So that's one of the things that I've been really enjoying about this whole thing. You know, the what we tried to achieve in the movie was this feeling of freshness. Iñárritu, the director, wanted something very visceral, in the moment, jazzy, improvised, and you know that's what we did. So when I'm doing it live, I try to stay true to the dramatic effect that we achieved during the you know on the original thing that you hear on the film. But when I'm doing it live, I try to stay true also to the spirit of improvisation, and I, you know, basically improvise the whole thing, but based on what I have done before.
Do you keep it still with just the drums and the cymbals?
Yeah, entirely. So it's something that I think is very unique. I don't think anybody has ever gone to a movie theater and seen a movie with a drummer kind of improvising on top of it. So I think it's pretty unique.
Yeah, when people have live music with a movie, it used to be an organist.
Right.
Or
nowadays they do orchestras. You know, yeah. I know they do it for The Lord of the Rings and other productions. But just to have a single person doing it live with a drum set, you know, that's pretty cool. Pretty
Are unique. You ever tempted to throw other percussion instruments in there? You suddenly wanted to play a cowbell or a maraca?
Not really. I mean, drums has been my bread and butter for all these years, and I've luckily gotten to know the instrument intimately, and you know I feel like I don't need anything else in order to express a lot of emotion.
So how do you decide when you're sitting in the theater in each different place? And pardon me, but how many different times are you doing this? Playing along with
this tour is like I think it's like 10 or 11 shows, but I've done a bunch before, but never on an actual tour. It's always been one-offs.
Right.
So yeah.
I mean, how do you decide when you sit down at the drums, or I should say, how early do you decide before you sit down what that soundtrack is going to be that night, whether you're going to be playing the rhythm along with footsteps, for example, whether or not you're going to, you know, do drum rolls leading up to a suspenseful part. When are those decisions made?
You know, as an improviser, all of that is kind of a mystery to me.
Even to you?
You know, yeah, because that's the cool thing. You know, this part of your brain is working on pure instinct. And then this other part of the brain is working on all the stuff you practiced and all the stuff you know how to do. So it's a combination of the two. But it's mainly that part of your brain that, you know, it's in a subconscious level that decides all those things on a split second. And I'm very glad that that's the way it works, because if I had to actually think of every little thing I have to do, that would be a nightmare, I think.
How different was it, though? I mean, the act of improvising in a jazz session is really different. You're taking your cues orally, right? Or at least through body language while you're watching another player. And that must be a really different challenge than watching a film, something that's not happening in the moment, right? A film is edited. It's highly scripted most mm-hmm. of the time. So that must be a different experience. How different is it?
I mean, part of it is different and part of it is the same, because I'm using the same set of instincts to react to things that are happening in front of me. So most of the time is in other members of the band that I'm reacting to, whatever they're playing, I react to that. But this time around, it's, you know, a script and acting and visuals. But I feel like it all kind of comes from the same place. Nowadays, I know the film so well. I mean, I've seen it, I don't know, probably over 30 times by now. So I know a lot of the dialogue. I really know the movement. So now I'm able to kind of interact with the film even better than when we did it originally. So, you know, a lot of times it happens that you make a record with the band and then you go out on tour to promote the record, and then you start really getting to know the music intimately. And most people would love to record that album that you did months before you started going on tour. You would like to record that after the tour.
Yeah, it would be very different.
You really,
right?
Know the music. Yeah. So I wish I could do the score now, because now I really, really know the film intimately, and I can interact with the dialogue and the movement, and you know, it's a lot of fun for me.
My guest is percussionist and composer Antonio Sanchez. He wrote the original score for the 2014 film Birdman, and he'll perform it live with a screening of that film this Friday at Emory University at 8 p.m. I wonder, Antonio, do you now, while you're watching other films, start, at least in your head, imagining what the percussion and drum soundtrack would sound like?
Yeah, I mean, I'm doing that all the time with anything. You know, I'm listening to any kind of music, you know, even if it's Beyoncé or something, and I'm thinking, oh, I would play this here and I would play this there. That's something that I cannot really avoid. Now, after having done this, I've also done a couple other films, small independent films, and there's a couple of other projects in the works. And you know, even though I consider myself a drummer first, I'm also a composer. So I'm thinking in a very orchestral and compositional way, even if I'm just playing drums or when I want to add some other instruments to it. So I would love to do some more film scoring, but adding other stuff.
You'd want to add in other instruments.
Yeah, especially electronics. I'm really excited and interested in what electronics can bring. As a matter of fact, I'm doing a solo record where it's just all drums and electronics, everything performed by me. And the avenues I found with this project are really, really cool, I think. So I would like to apply that to future projects.
So, I mean, you brought up Beyoncé, so I feel like I have to ask, is there a particular mm-hmm. song of hers that you would redo the percussion on?
Everything, probably.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, that happens to me. You know, except for a few very specific bands that I'm an incredibly, you know, avid fan of the drumming. I feel like I would love to play over a bunch of different tracks that people have done over these. But, you know, that doesn't mean it would be better. It would just be different.
Yeah, I mean, most people who are not trained musicians have no way of evaluating one drummer against another drummer. I mean, people can say, you know, Phil Collins is my favorite drummer, or maybe, you know, they can point to another rock drummer and say they're the best. But they have most people have no point of context. So what do you listen for? I don't mean even a jazz drummer, which is a different challenge of its own, but even in pop music, what are you listening for to tell whether or not a drummer knows his or her craft?
Well, you know, at a very high level, I think every drummer really knows their craft. You know, and even if it's a pop drummer, or a country drummer, or a jazz, I mean, whatever style you're talking about, I think people that are recording albums and going on tour, everybody knows their craft. So, but what I'm really want from a drummer, of course, besides having amazing time, which is the most important part, I really want them to have a particular recognizable sound. Like, for example, Stuart Copeland from The Police, or John Bonham from Led Zeppelin, or Neil Peart from Rush. All these are, you know, were very popular bands, but the drums were very, very recognizable. And I feel like in pop music and in rock music, sometimes that's hard to do. But I feel like lately it has become very generic, you know, the sound and the style. I don't feel like we're going through a time where pop drummers or rock drummers have very distinctive sounds. I feel like jazz drummers, usually the successful ones, have very distinctive style and sound. So that's one of the things that I'm always looking for, just a very specific, recognizable style and the sound of the drums themselves.
And you yourself are a favorite drummer among some pretty well-known musicians. I mean, I mentioned Pat Metheny and Chick Corea, but you have played with a ton of really great musicians. What is required then? I mean, we were talking about you playing drums alone for the film or a film soundtrack, but when you become part of a quartet or a trio, when you become part of a band, what do you have to change in your style?
Well, you have to be a team player, obviously. I feel like the drummer should be the unifier and the engine in a band. So it doesn't matter if it's a trio, a quartet, a septet, or a big band. I think you are the glue that should be joining every moving part of that specific band. So if you have 15 players, you know, and there's, you know, the bass is doing something and the piano is doing something and the horns are doing something, you are the one that is going to play the stuff in between all their notes that is going to make it, you know, a cohesive unit. So that's the hardest thing to do. And it's a very delicate balance between doing that and then creating enough energy, enough momentum, proposing things, but not imposing things. You know, as a rhythm section player, your job is to make everybody sound as good as they can sound. I feel like a really good drummer with an okay band, the overall product is pretty good. But a good band with a mediocre drummer, it's not going to be that good. It's not going to feel that great. So the feel, the sound, and the cohesiveness, I think it's those are the main jobs of a good drummer.
And in a way, you're also the safety net, right? I mean, you're the one that's there to catch everything. Should anything go wrong, as long as the drummer is rock steady, you can kind of avert catastrophe, can you not?
Yes, definitely. I mean, everybody is usually relying on us, and everything is our fault, good or bad, most of the time. So it's a delicate job that we have. But, I mean, I wouldn't trade it for anything in this world.
Okay, so that's one side of you. So what is it that you like, then, about films?
Well, of course, you know, the juxtaposition of very cool, breathtaking images with cool, breathtaking sounds, to me, that's always interesting, you know. When I heard, for example, my drums for the first time in a movie theater with surround sound, juxtaposed with those amazing images from this film, I was blown away. You know, I just never thought that was possible. And I've heard my drums a million times in different contexts, you know, on CDs and LPs and videos, but never in a movie theater with a movie of that caliber and that cinematography. So to me, that was really mind-boggling and kind of got the bug to do more of that.
Antonio Sanchez, percussionist and composer. He wrote the score for the film Birdman from 2014, and he will perform a live performance for a screening of that film this Friday at Emory University at 8 p.m. Antonio, such a pleasure. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today, but as always, we'd love to hear from you. What is your favorite movie soundtrack? And do you actually sometimes like the music more than the movie? Call and tell us at 404-500-9457. You can leave a message there. We're on Twitter. The show is at OSD Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley, or you can post on Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.